Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Barbara Park and I'm the current president. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter your age and your abilities or inabilities. Toward the end of the service today, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can get to know you better. On Sunday morning, we provide a wide variety of services presented by members of the Prairie community, the wider community, or our new minister, Jane Espenson, who will present for the first time formally as our minister on October 9th. Nick will read our opening words.
Thank you, Barb. The opening words are from the book of Amos, chapter 5, verse 24. Let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream.
The law will never make men free. It is men that have to make the law free.
Our program today is presented by two members of the Prairie community. Nick Abbs has been a Prairie member for a year and a half. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School in 2008, where he developed some experiences with law's moral issues in the criminal justice system. He currently practices estate planning and financial planning and is head of the program committee here at Prairie. And his co-presenter is Ken Haydock, who's been a friend of Prairie for more than a year. Originally from New York, he was raised as a Unitarian, holds an AB in government from Columbia, and a JD from the Wisconsin Law School. He values highly America's historic separation of church and state, and so we welcome them for their presentation.
First of all, I'll say that Ken probably should have been introduced first because this program is really his brainchild. So with that, I will say no more.
You're kind. Is this microphone working for everyone? Good. For the benefit of any newcomers or visitors, no two programs at Prairie, probably no 10 consecutively, are ever the same. This will be no exception. The program consists conceptually of sort of three pieces, and we're only going to be presenting two of those pieces. The first piece consists of a concern that Nick and I share with respect to the perception of the relationship between law and morality. After we conclude that, we're going to spend a little time illustrating some ways in which our American legal system operates, maybe in ways that seem strange. Now, logically, okay, law and morality, then law. What would be next? A discussion of morality. As it happens, neither Nick nor I is a moral philosopher, and this is a Unitarian Universalist society. So the responsibility for determining what morality is and what is appropriate rests on your side of the podium. Okay? So what we are here to do is raise a concern, give you some illustrations that are consonant with that, and then leave to you answering some of the questions that we're going to raise. Let me begin. I want to put this in context. A great deal of American history gets rewritten these days. There's a best-selling book that just came out in paperback with the thesis that late 20th century American liberal politics has its roots in early 20th century European fascism. Yes. This is a bestseller. Don't shoot the messenger, I'm just telling you. American economic history has been rewritten. There are a lot of people who will tell you in all earnestness that the policies and activities of the New Deal did nothing, underscore nothing, to end the Great Depression, whereas there are accessible, verifiable, reliable statistics that disprove that assertion. American religious history gets rewritten. There are some people who would have you believe that all of the founders and all of the framers were basically Pat Robertson-style evangelical Baptists, with the exception, of course, of Thomas Paine, but not necessarily the exception of Thomas Jefferson. People are saying this, okay? This rewrite has extended to American law. Now, what is the origin of American law? Well, our legal system derives from the English legal system. Stress English, not British. Scotland has its own legal system. There's no such thing in Scotland as trespass, as long as you don't break anything while you're walking across your neighbor's property. Different system. We inherited that system because there were 13 colonies that became the original 13 states, and they kept the legal system that had existed here under British rule, English rule. Where did England get its legal system? Well, it kind of grew up over the 1500s and 1600s. There were a variety of different courts and tribunals. Each had its own area of interest. And gradually, over time, they began to merge together. And by the mid-1700s, in structure, it was very similar to what we're familiar with today. We don't have a complete merger of like the criminal courts and the civil courts, but basically a lot of different approaches to problem solving, to enforcing laws, were brought together. Now, if you ask some people, however, the origin of American law is the Bible. Why would anybody think that? Why would somebody believe that? Here's my thesis, and Nick and I have talked about this, and we kind of agree on it. If this were a gathering of Muslims, what would we have been taught? From Allah comes Al-Quran. And from the Quran and the Hadith and related sources, we derive the law. If we were a gathering of Orthodox Jews, what would we have been taught? From Adonai comes Torah. And from the Torah and the Talmud and related sources, we derive the law. Okay. Well, what if instead we were a gathering of people, a mixture of Protestants and Catholics, in England in the year 1701? We'd have a king, his name James, the seventh of that name to be king of Scotland, and at the same time, the second of that name to be king of England. In Scotland, he's still referred to as James the Seventh and Second. We know him as James the Second. Okay. Now, he had a motto. Lots of kings had mottos. His motto, which a high school friend of mine loved and used to recite all the time for no particular reason, his motto was, "A Deo Rex, a Rege Lex." From God comes the king, from the king comes the law. See a parallel to what we were talking about before. Now, it happens that in September of 1701, on the 16th, James died. And he was replaced initially by a couple of borrowed monarchs from Holland, William and Mary, and they were followed by Anne. And from those three to this day, there is an unbroken line of Protestant monarchs. James was the last Catholic monarch in Great Britain. Okay? Now it's the mid-1700s. We got the colonies. We're feeling a little rebellious. When we framed, the framers framed the Constitution, when the founders founded the country, did they take this from on high through some intermediate stage to the law approach. Now, Nick and I don't see that we did. Could we have? Sure. If you think about it, somebody living in the 1750s, 1760s, 1770s wouldn't have personal knowledge of the year 1701, but that would be recent history. The parents, teachers, you know, this is within living memory at that point. Okay. So there's this view of history that's been altered somewhat. Now, should that be a concern to us? Well, here's a quote that Nick will read to us from someone who has a different view than Nick and I share.
Because every law springs from a system of values and beliefs, every law is an instance of legislating morality. Further, because a nation's laws always exercise a pedagogical or teaching influence, law inescapably exerts a shaping effect over the beliefs, character, and actions of a nation's citizens, whether for good or ill. Those who seek to separate morality from law, therefore, are in pursuit of both the impossible and the destructive. The question before us is never whether or not to legislate morality, but which moral system ought to be made legally binding.
This is from a preface written to an article about the First Amendment by a fellow who teaches theology and culture at Hillsdale College in Michigan. His academic background lies in biblical studies and theology, not law. And in case you think this is taken too much out of context, the subtitle of the article for which this is part of the preface is "The Falsity, Futility, and Folly of Separating Morality from Law." Let me underscore two phrases in the last sentence that Nick read for us. One was moral system. This is consonant with the notion that morality exists in discrete, internally consistent systems, and there are several of them, and we should select the evangelical Christian model, okay, because it's the best, and make it, his words, legally binding on you, on us, okay? Should that be of concern? Well, Nick and I are concerned. Hear now from a different academic, an observer of America, and his thoughts about what kind of a system it would be in which a given moral system is legally binding.
Absolutism rules the minds of a great number of people in the world today, most dangerously so in the incipient American theocracy.
An alarmist? The guy's a professor of science at Oxford. That's from page 324 of The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. America as an incipient theocracy. Well, we have this thought, okay, law, you know, from coming from on high. At any point in Western thought, hasn't somebody said, well, you know, there are times, even though law and morality agree you shouldn't kill people, you know, you shouldn't commit murder, certainly, there are things that are moral, there are things that are law, and sometimes law and morality are at loggerheads. Has anybody ever thought that? Quote from a third academic.
At first, there seems to be no distinction between law and morality. But it is not long before thoughtful people recognize the difference between what is actually legal, or legally right according to the political authorities, and what should be legal. Sometimes this is expressed as an opposition between what the gods command, representing what is morally right, and what the political authorities command, representing what is legally right. This is dramatically illustrated in Sophocles' tragedy Antigone, in which the heroine defies the decree of the king, which is the source of legal right under the circumstances, and buries her brothers, an act the audience would assume was morally right.
Okay, three things about this quote. It's from a fellow named Jan Edward Garrett, who is a professor of philosophy and religion at Western Kentucky University. He has a PhD from Minnesota, and he's a Unitarian Universalist, which I discovered weeks after I found this quote. The second thing, which I can't resist, is just for English buffs. He says, okay, law and morality can be at loggerheads. This is dramatically illustrated by a play. I love it. I mean, but let's get serious. Return to the play, Sophocles' Antigone. It was first staged in 442 BC. By my calculation, that means that somewhere in Western thought, for the past 98 human generations, has been the notion that maybe law and morality aren't intertwined and inextricable. Now, we're going to segue into focusing on law, but for a moment, if you go to a dictionary, G.C. Merriam-Webster's Ninth Collegiate, and you look up morality and morals, the definition is made in terms of conduct and behavior. If you look up the definition of law, and this is what attorneys call a civilian dictionary, it's not a legal dictionary, part of the definition is that law is a means of redressing wrongs. Now, I don't think that's the best overview of the law. I'll get into that in a second. But I'll give the dictionary full credit for describing law and morality in very different terms. I would add, you know, conduct to me sounds like what you're supposed to do now and in the future. And if you're redressing wrongs, when did they occur? In the past? So it's these are different enterprises. They operate differently. How differently? This is where we start focusing on law. Here's an illustration of a point we'll come back to. Modern America, a crime is committed. Somebody commits a crime, gets caught, gets charged, is tried, in my example, is convicted, serves his or her sentence. At this point, what is the status under the law? Done deal. That's it. Okay? What we have achieved is something, you know, a form of resolution. And some legal writers refer to it as repose. The matter is put to rest. Now, back over here when the crime was committed, it could have involved the loss of a human limb or a human life. Did this process answer the moral question? Did the person going through that process and paying his or her debt to society change the loss of life, the loss of limb, or how a moral system might deal with that event? What took place, was it the law? Was it morality in play? Let's get out of criminal law and look at a will contest. We're now in trusts and estates. And the following, I believe, is an actual case, but it certainly illustrates how the law treats a last will and testament. Okay? Father is very wealthy. He owns a very rich farm, very valuable farm. It's in his own name. And he wants to leave the farm, implements, crops, and cattle to mother. And then everything else to the kids. He goes to an attorney. The attorney drafts a will. The father looks it over. Yeah, that looks fine. They go through what's called a will signing ceremony. And the will is valid. It was properly witnessed. Everything about it is just fine. Now, in among trust and estates attorneys, no one dies. They stop breathing. Heart stops, the brain isn't working. No, their estate matures. So, sadly for him, father's estate matures. And the kids get a hold of the will, and they notice something. The will is supposed to read, I leave to mother my farm, comma, implements, comma, crops, comma, and cattle, and to the children, all the rest and the remainder of my estate. Here's what got written in the will. The attorney made an error. I leave to mother my farm, implements, comma, the crops and the cattle, and all the rest and remainder of my estate to the children. Now, we know what father's intent was. But what happens when that will gets before a judge? Well, in our system of law, if you got a valid will, and it can be interpreted literally, we interpret it literally. And so the kids wind up with the farm, and mom winds up with cattle, crops, and farm implements. Okay? Now, I ask you, is that fair? Is that just? Is that moral? It is the law. Why? Think about it. Do you really want to have a jury trial every time somebody dies? The reason for it is something called judicial economy. We want to minimize the amount of time, expense, and effort associated with what? Bringing matters to repose. Okay, see the parallel between what we did in criminal law and what we're talking about here. Another example. This one's a little more dramatic. It involves tort law. In every tort case I ever read, even if it didn't use the word unbeknownst, you can't. There's always some hapless person. This is an actual case, Oregon in the mid-1950s. A woman is driving her car along the highway, and she goes under an overpass. Ready for it? Unbeknownst to her, on the overpass is a gasoline tanker truck filled with gasoline, spinning out of control. And in short order, an event occurs in which the gasoline truck winds up on top of the car, an explosion occurs, flame occurs. Yes, her estate matures. Now, sad event. When this matter reaches the court, members of the family suing the oil company, it damages loss of life, what do you suppose the first question that the judge is most concerned with will be? No. The judge wants to settle the question. And bear in mind, the answer to this question cannot be known. Nobody could possibly know it, in fact. Did she die as a result of being squashed or as a result of the fire? Why? Why would that be? Here's why. If somebody has got a tanker truck and transports along our highways and through our neighborhoods milk or water, what standard do we hold them to? Negligence. We don't want you to be negligent. We want you to make sure the truck is in proper repair, properly licensed, the driver is properly trained, properly licensed, sober, driving at the right speed limit, appropriate, you know, whatever is appropriate for road conditions and weather conditions. And if you're doing all those things, you may not be liable for damages that occur. It's an accident, okay? But what if the substance that you're transporting through, you know, down the highways and through the streets is really, really scary. Nuclear waste, chlorine gas, something that could explode and burn, like, oh, I don't know, gasoline. The legal standard you're then held to is something called strict liability. All we care about is whose truck and whose gasoline is it. Once we know that, you're liable. And now we worry about for how much or in what ways. So, What does the judge decide? How did she die? She died as a result of the fire. Why? It shortens the trial. We don't have 2 weeks of people talking about how good the truck was maintained and what a nice driver it was and how their safety record and stuff like that. This is really dangerous stuff. We use a different legal standard with respect to it. Okay? And we can start the trial at the point, whose truck was it? Okay, you guys, whose ultra-hazardous material, it's called, was in the truck? End of worrying about that stuff. Now, how liable? What's the dollar value? What things need to be done as a result? Is that fair? Is that just? Is that moral? It is the law. Did it sound like a moral question was being addressed there? Okay, we've got one more example. And for this purpose, we need a little suspension of disbelief. I'll tell you when. The federal government has passed a law, and it says that if you import certain citrus fruits, you've got to pay a duty. And it doesn't mention anything about oranges, but it says if it's lemons, you pay 10 cents a standard container for the lemons you import. And if it's tangerines, then it's 20 cents. Now, you didn't know it, but you guys are the Prairie UU Import Company. And here's where you suspend disbelief. You have to believe that Tangelos are a 50-50 hybrid between lemons and tangerines. I mean, they've got lemony zing, and they kind of taste like tangerines. I assume that biology isn't right, but for our purposes, yeah, that's necessary. So you guys had started up, and you're selling Tangelos like they're going out of style, and you've covered your startup costs, and you have paid nothing. Well, the IRS gets hold of this. The IRS grabs a U.S. attorney, Nick, and says, we're supposed to be getting money here. So here, Nick will address the court on the subject of, and we care about this. If it is no duty, we're just raking in the money hands over fist. If it's 10 cents, we're still well past break even, and we're doing nicely, and everybody gets hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So we care, okay? 20 cents, insolvency, bankruptcy, you're out of business, okay? The U.S. attorney.
May it please the court. Our federal government, our democratically elected representatives, have in their infinite wisdom made an affirmative choice to tax certain citrus fruits with the qualities of tangerines and lemons. I say that they made an affirmative choice because it's important to remember that without definitions, we have to infer the intent of the legislature. And in this case, making the affirmative decision to tax shows a recognition that there is a quality about tangerines and a quality about lemons worthy of taxation. Otherwise, we put ourselves in danger of going down a slippery slope wherein any importer or grower may attempt to practice tax evasion by simply making minor, even cosmetic changes to their tangerines or to their lemons and call them something different. Make up a different name and say, this is not a tangerine, therefore I may not be taxed. By all rights, since this particular fruit has both the qualities of the tangerine and the lemon, it should be taxed as both a tangerine and a lemon. But at the very least, I ask the court that it be taxed the 20 cents of a tangerine because it does have that quality of a tangerine, which our legislature has again affirmatively decided is worthy of, merits, in fact, a 20 cent tax. The government rests.
Boy, you had a look. I'm your attorney. May it please the court. Your Honor, the statute in question here makes no reference to oranges. And the question of whether oranges should be taxed is not in dispute here. We're agreed the law does not apply to oranges. Oranges are not named in the statute. Neither are tangelos. Had the legislature wished to impose a duty upon tangelos, they could have. They did not. We believe that there should be no taxation, no duties imposed, whatever. However, Your Honor, if for some reason the court believes that tangelos do come under the purview of this law, we would ask that they be taxed at no higher a rate than 10 cents, because the only citrus fruit taxed at the higher rate are tangerines, and this is not a tangerine. We're agreed on that point. The defense rests. Did you think that was a moral argument? We've made basically the points that we wish to. The idea is to share a concern about a different view than I know we share, and many of you would, about the nature of the law. I leave you with a couple of thoughts. Every time you cross a state line, the law changes. Does morality? Every time the state legislature sits or Congress sits, the law changes. Whoop. Lawyers are mutable. But does morality? And I'd also want to note, at the end of a formal affidavit, appear the words, "Further, affiant, say it not," which means, and I'll draw the parallel here, that's what we wanted to say. Okay? We have time for questions, talk back.
You know, I had heard a quote, and I can't remember who said it, the idea is that our laws should, a rule or a law should be just as applicable and effective in those rare and unusual cases as it is in kind of the expected cases. And I think what that sort of said to me is that in a lot of cases that's not the case, and it means that our laws are not meant to look at outside considerations like is it fair to treat our domestic growers in a certain way and our foreign importers in a different way. You have the text of the law, and there are many people who get paid, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to pore over that text and interpret it without thinking about the outside considerations. Now, in my argument, I brought into the argument the intent of the legislature. If I hadn't brought in that argument, where would we be? The question of fairness doesn't come into play. It's simply, what does the law say and what is the text? So I think that that's a tension that the law always has. How do you account for that when you're writing a statute?
And we have just enough time. I'm going to do a very, very abbreviated version of another example that we cut, purely speculative. Drive up my car to Capitol Square, and I park in a parking spot that happens to be free, never happens, and feed the meter, which works, $12.50, whatever. I go across the street, I run my errand at a shop, the meter's only good for 15 minutes, somebody next to me falls to the floor. Since this is a hypothetical, somehow or other, I know CPR, and I'm breathing, and I'm doing the chest compressions and using American Sign Language to say, please call 911. And the person, you know, the EMTs come, the person survives, and I get back to my car 17 minutes later, and there's a parking ticket on it, right? I'm mad. I pull away. And just one of the nastiest people we know, Pat, pulls up in her car. She this is a hypothetical. Come on. She pulls up in her car and gets out. She feeds the meter, and she goes into the same store, and she's got the usual thing she always carries, the bag, the bandana, the Bowie knife, puts it on her face, and she holds everybody up at knife point. She gets the money from the cash register and all the wallets and all the, and she makes it back to her car in 5 minutes. She did a really good job. You're good at this. Pat, you're good at this. And she drives off. Now, I saved a life and I get a parking ticket, and Pat used the same real estate to commit multiple felonies, and she gets what? It's not necessarily fair, but the alternative, think of this, Dane County and Jason County taxpayers, you want to have a jury trial every time somebody gets a parking ticket? The law's concerns are different. Where fairness can be had, the law tries to do that, but it's not always possible, and I apologize. What I thought was the interesting phrase that you used is, how can we term what, you know, what's right for everyone? We can go the route of Michael Bauman, who is the professor at Hillsdale College, and there'll be one system of morality, it will be made legally binding. Alternatively, we can live with ambiguity, and we can have a system that tolerates a range of possibilities, and you can do any of that stuff as long as it doesn't violate the law as interpreted by the courts. It's not easy. It's not. It doesn't feel warm and cuddly. You know. It's not high school civics. But it's kind. Yeah. Exactly. And consistent with that, my personal definition of the law is whatever a judge of a court of competent jurisdiction says it is in your case at the point that for whatever reason, you can't proceed any further. And that may include running out of money. But the object again, and it runs through virtually all areas of the law, the object is to get to resolution, repose. And if that can be done folding in a sense of what's right and what's fair, great. That's not always possible. If you're in a neighborhood and you discovered that there's a large supply of bread that somebody has, and there are a large number of people who are starving, if you take the bread and give it to the starving people, that's theft. Is it immoral under all circumstances to do that? And when you pay the price, you ultimately, hopefully, achieve repose with respect to the law. No, there is, if you think of it as two circles that overlap, there is overlap. There's some things that people in general would say, you know, is morally right and is enforced by the law. That's true. But there are vast areas of law that operate with other concerns, saving time and money and effort and avoiding ongoing disputes, you know, Hatfields versus McCoys kinds of things. Our First Amendment kind of addresses that. And I'm kind of fond of that.
Thank you so much, Ken and Nick. That was clearly a very intellectually stimulating presentation. I have a feeling we're going to be mulling this around for a long time. And join us for coffee.